BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello. The latest children's TV show to put visual impairment at the forefront and with an emphasis on sound and music. But first, the government has published their 10-year plan for the NHS in England following a public consultation. It promises to make the NHS fit for the future by focusing on three core areas: hospital to community, analogue to digital, and sickness to prevention. But how might it apply to eye care in particular? Well, joining me is Adam Sampson, who's chief executive of the Association of Optometrists and who's been looking at the plan in detail. Adam, given that eye care isn't mentioned specifically a great deal in the master plan, how confident are you that this is the change in eye care that you've been looking for and we've been looking for?
Well, certainly it's consistent in general with the sort of things that not just people like high street opticians, optometrists have been saying, but also what some ophthalmologists have been arguing and patient groups like RNIB or other charities have been arguing for. But you're right. First of all, there's no huge mention of eye care in it. There are one or two useful indications that eye care isn't completely forgotten, which actually, frankly, in past it has been. So the Prime Minister did name check eye care in his speech. But I think our real concern is less about what the plan says. It's more about how government is now going to seek to deliver it.
Right. Well, let's look at a few specifics. Your organisation in particular has been calling for the move towards utilising high street optometrists in order to bring down ophthalmology waiting lists and things like that. Are you hopeful that the emphasis on community-led care will lead to that?
Certainly the indications are good, but there is danger in this. Yes, government is saying they're going to reduce waiting lists. Yes, they're saying they're going to move services out of hospital, but they're saying that they're going to do that at precisely the same time as they cut considerable amounts of money out of the commissioning process, that they will be creating a new digital NHS app to improve patient control. Now, doing all those things simultaneously in a health system which hasn't delivered hugely well in reform terms over the last 10 years, that's a big ask.
And is there also a danger that all elements of the eye care service will be speaking the same language? I mean, in response to the plan, the Royal College of Ophthalmologists say that consultants' oversight is essential to ensuring quality referrals, accurate diagnoses, and safe treatment pathways. I mean, is there maybe still a tension between the optometrists wanting things in the community and the ophthalmologists wanting, you know, the best diagnostic equipment and expertise to be available, which perhaps they still think are in hospitals?
There's no question that not everything can be moved into the community all at once. And to that extent, we agree. But inevitably, a shift from hospital to the community is going to, as well as empowering community providers, it will disempower hospitals. And the money will move out of hospital budgets into community budgets. So it's scarcely surprising if some of the secondary care voices are uncomfortable with some of what's being said. And the Royal College of Ophthalmologists are not alone in of the doctors' voices in arguing that. But actually, the government really has no choice. We have massive shortages of ophthalmologists in this country. That's one of the major reasons there are so many people on the waiting lists. You can't simply say everything has got to be overseen by an ophthalmologist if there aren't enough ophthalmologists to go round. As well, government does know that services done in a hospital setting are much more expensive. They know that patients prefer to be dealt with closer to home, so long as they can trust the relationship they have with their clinical providers. And there is no shortage of equipment or trained clinical staff in high street optometry. So actually, government really doesn't have much choice. If it wants to bring down the waiting lists, it does mean it's going to have to make more use of community optometry than it has in the past. And ministers have repeatedly said their intentions are to do just that.
Now, you mentioned the push towards digital solutions and the NHS app being the main point of contact for patients and accessing their records, doing things like making appointments and so forth. The plan describes it as patients having a doctor in their pocket. But what could this digital push mean for visually impaired people?
If they get it right, it will be amazing. The difficulty with this is you look at the history of digital solutions, not just in the NHS, but in government generally, and your heart sinks a little bit. What they've got to invent is an app that not only works for secondary care, but works for the providers who are not necessarily mainstream hospital providers, so the dentists, the pharmacists, the GPs, the optometrists. The app has to be suitable for them. And it's got to be suitable for patients. And then above all else, this app is going to have to work for people who are visually impaired. And I have a real concern that if they get the app wrong, then the adaptations that are going to be necessary for the visually impaired community won't be thought of until far too late in the day. So it is essential that people from the visually impaired community aren't just forced down an app route with no other an alternative.
There is promise of a single patient record, presumably the idea being that there can be a more joined up way of sharing data and images across care settings. What effect will that have? Because that's something, again, that your association has been complaining there hasn't been so far.
Again, if they get it right, it will be superb. One of the encouraging things in the 10-year plan is their use of an example from optometry of just that happening in Gloucestershire, where optometrists in Gloucestershire can share details of eye scans directly with GPs and hospitals, which you'd have thought would be common sense all over the country, but is so unusual in NHS terms that government's picked it out as an example of good practice. That sort of stuff has got to be ubiquitous. We are in a situation where high street optometrists aren't able to do that very much. If you go to your optician will not necessarily be able to see what your medical records are, let alone share the results of the really extremely good quality scans that most opticians are now capable of taking. Often, those scans have got to be repeated in a hospital setting. If we're looking to move care into the community, close to where patients live, then digital connectivity is absolutely essential.
So, Adam, on a scale of 1 to 10, how optimistic are you about this?
For intent, I think we'd have to give the government 9 out of 10 for intent, but I have a real, real concern now about delivery. So I have my fingers very firmly crossed.
Adam Sampson, thank you very much for joining us. Now, meet Maddie and Triggs.
Listen to all these tiny noises. I wonder how loud the noises would be if we were tiny too.
Oh, let's be as quiet as teeny tiny things.
Maddie and Triggs shrink down to a tiny size.
There's a knock, knock, knock at the pipes.
Well, Maddie, a 7-year-old visually impaired girl, and her pet dog Triggs are the central characters of the latest children's TV programme from Irish studio Turnip and Duck. It's featured on Ireland's national broadcaster RTE and CBeebies. The emphasis of this show is very much music and sounds, as the characters find adventure by really listening to the everyday sounds around them. Well, joining me is the blind lyricist behind the music of Maddie and Triggs that you heard there, Dina Diamond, and the audio description lead is Oran O'Neill. But first, let's speak to Colm Tobin, who's the managing director at Turnip and Duck. Colm, first of all, give us a bit more of an overview of the show. I may have already done it for you and spoilt your pitch, but just describe in a bit more detail the characters and the world they're in.
Well, Maddie is a 7-year-old girl who loves music and sound and adventure. And she lives in the little town of Higgledy Piggledy with her best friend and her pet doggy, Triggs, who shares her love of sound and music and adventure. And they're surrounded by a cast of colourful, wonderful characters, some imaginary, some from the real world around them.
And there's a lot of emphasis in the creation of this show that visually impaired people were to be as involved as possible. Just explain what you did and how you did it.
I guess, yeah, going back to the start of where this project came out of, it actually came out of a conversation between myself and Oren. Oren was doing the audio description on one of our previous shows, and he made a comment saying how well it worked for blind and vision impaired audiences, I think because it was kind of dialogue-led and kind of gag-led. It struck us that it was a real afterthought that we were delivering the audio description. It was kind of a contractual obligation. So it struck us that it could be a real creative challenge. You know, how could we consider the audience from the start? And the mission of the show was if two kids, one sighted and one vision impaired, were to sit down side by side to watch the show, that neither would have a lesser experience. One of the first things we did was we engaged with Vision Ireland here, and we decided that like an audio first approach would make sense in terms of how are we going to make a TV show that can work on both levels. But we really knew very little about this world, so then we kind of had to listen to people, which is what we started to do.
Now Maddie is voiced by Bonnie Mira, I think, who's visually impaired herself. She plays the 7-year old, and there was a happy coincidence, I think, when you found her.
Oh, it was so wonderful. With Vision Ireland, again, we put out a casting call and had some brilliant auditions in from vision impaired kids all around Ireland. And we knew we were looking for a very specific thing. We were looking for someone who could act, who was 7 years old or thereabouts, who was legally blind and could also sing some really quite ambitious songs and do some quite ambitious music. So that was a pretty hard call from a casting perspective. But Bonnie happened to be living up the road from us, going to the same school as our kids. It was like the universe was telling us already there's something happening here. And Bonnie came in and she voiced and sang all the songs on the original 15-part podcast, which is what we led the show with.
And you said you looked for visually impaired writers. How easy was it to find them? I mean, and what was your success rate, as it were?
It was very low. So we put out a call and, you know, nothing really came back. But we struck gold in terms of finding out about Dina, and Dina being a comedy writer based in the States who works as part of a musical partnership. She does lyrics as well. Beyond that, there was no preschool writers per se that we felt we could find. So we launched a shadow scheme for blind and vision impaired writers, which I don't know if it's the first of its kind in the world. It was certainly the first of its kind here. And it's the first time we've done anything like that. We have 10 writers who are totally new to it, and they got basically a kind of a crash course in writing for animation. And 4 of those writers, including Oren, went on to graduate and got their full script commissions and full episodes on the show.
Well, we'll be talking to Oren in a minute, but let me bring in Dina first, Dina Diamond, getting up early for us in Washington State. So Dina, explain your involvement with this.
Oh my goodness. It's been a wonderful experience. When I first met with Aiden and Colm, they already had the podcast and they had 15 episodes. And I listened to that and was blown away as a blind writer and songwriter. It was everything that I have been banging my head against the wall to try and do here in the States for years and years and years. But sadly, the United States was not open to having a show with a character with a disability.
Really? I mean, that's surprising in a way. Were you surprised?
It's unbelievable because for years I've been writing on shows and I've been allowed to introduce blind characters on different series that I've written on, preschool series, but to have a lead has just been a fight. So when I met these brilliant guys in Ireland who were able to do it, like, yes, please let me be part of this. So I felt so fortunate to have this opportunity to, one, meet these guys who had so much foresight in what the world should be and how inclusive it should be. But then also to find out that they're musicians too, and it's a music-based show. Hello, you're speaking my language.
Right.
Let me in.
And you also work with Bonnie, who plays Maddie, on the musical recordings. What was that process like?
Oh, Bonnie is a true talent. And no matter what we threw at her, she was ready for the challenge. She always came in 100% prepared. And we hit her with every genre of music, from a rock opera.
There was a clanging of battle. It was a big, busy battle.
To a power ballad.
It's hard, I know, but he'll be good as new.
To reggae. You name it, she did it and was a star every step of the way.
Let me bring Oran O'Neill in, who is himself blind. He's the audio description lead at RTE. He's also a podcaster and a lead audio description specialist on Maddie and Triggs. Oran, you got involved in the show, and we know that kind of arose out of a conversation, but were you surprised to get this opportunity?
Yeah, very surprised. I really hadn't done any writing, creative writing at all. My own role in terms of audio description is assigning projects and reviewing scripts and what have you. So I might get the opportunity to rewrite part of an audio description script, but hadn't thought about writing at all for kids' animation. But as we went on and went on and drafted more and more scripts and learned how the whole process works, I really found that I had a very keen interest and wanted to kind of pursue this. And then when the guy said, you know, put in a pitch, but I didn't expect it to get commissioned. So my episode is kind of a true story. Triggs, he meets a guide dog and their owner, and Triggs is having a very hard time trying to figure out why the guide dog won't play with Triggs. And the episode is kind of just to show how guide dogs are trained. Kind of a fun play on distractions and how good and well-trained guide dogs are. And I'm still writing to this day, so I've really got the bug now for it, yeah.
There's one thing I must ask you, Colm. We've mentioned the writing course and, you know, we've heard Oran say, you know, what an eye-opener. I'm allowed to make that joke for us. Can people get involved with that in the future? Is that going to be a running plan, really?
That's what we would love to do. I guess we are a very, very small company, so really do need the bigger stakeholders, the training agencies in the industry, just to row in behind us a little bit. So we did the first one kind of as a test in Ireland with 10 writers. We'd like to extend that to the UK for series two, when and if that happens. There's so much I think we learned ourselves as producers in terms of running that program for series one, you know, how difficult that can be in terms of making software accessible, all of those learning curves that we never would have considered before. I think we're trying to catalog all that intel, and we're trying to share it widely within the industry, just to kind of show other studios and companies, you know, this is doable. And it, not only is it doable, but it makes your content and it makes your creative work all the better for it, because you're bringing in new voices who bring just a different skew on things and a totally different perspective.
It's great to meet you all on In Touch, and we'll be watching this progress with great interest. Colm Tobin, Oran O'Neill, Dina Diamond, thank you all very much indeed. And that's it for today. But one last thing before we go. We're keen to hear from people about their experiences with access to banking. This is something that we've touched on quite often, but this is for an upcoming collaboration we're planning with Rip Off Britain. How accessible is your bank? Any issues? Let us know. You can email in touch at bbc.co.uk.